Okay, well, thank you. I hope everybody can hear me. And so let's start. So let's start actually by explaining what I'm actually going to talk about. So what is a dilate? Dilate is exactly what you think it is. Namely, you take a set, and in this talk of sets, I'm going to talk about a set of integers. Nothing fancier than that. So you take a set, and to dilate it L lambda times means take every element of your set, and just multiply it by lambda. So if you to dilate of a set, just double every element. And the question that I'm going to talk about for the next, 19 minutes, is how large the set of dilates of some fixed set is. Okay. Before I plunge you to talk, let me tell you that there is plenty of time, so if you want to interrupt and ask a question, if you don't understand something, do so. Because I am going to tell you lies during the talk, which you might not believe. Okay, so let's start with lower bounds. So the simplest sum of dilate there is A plus A. You just take a set and add it to itself. And as probably all of you know, even those who don't know what the major theorem is, this A plus A has size at least twice the size of A minus 1. The proof is rather simple. It's just induction of the size of the set, for example. Each time you add an element which is larger than everything else, you get two new elements. Nothing hard. The next hardest case is A plus 2A. So you double the set, add it to itself. Then it's still possible to show that it is at least approximately three times what it started to be. And the first time it was done, I believe, by Nathanson. And yes, I can give a quotation, citation, and you couldn't find anything earlier. So probably, I don't know. And again, the proof is follows the same idea, induction. Add another element, you get three more elements to the sum set, and it works. And this can be pushed. You can do it for A plus 3A, and you get exactly what you think it is. It grows four times, like arithmetic progression would grow. Take arithmetic progression, dilate it by three times, add it back itself, it grows four times, minus some constant. And this, I wrote down the proof. And it was also done independently by, I hope I pronounced it correctly, Siluero, Silvanuesa. I hope it's approximately correct. And now, the problem with this, that if the first two proofs are relatively short, the y plus 2 plus a takes no space whatsoever, so I could have written zero lines, but, well, I should have. I wrote one line. The second one takes slightly more space, but it's still fairly short. The third of this, embarrassingly long. It takes a whole page of case checking because each time you add a new element, there are many possibilities where you can interact with the existing elements. And one might think that this length of the third proof is maybe due to the fact that, well, we aren't smart enough or something, you know, just artifacts of the proof. However, there is a good reason to believe that this is not the case. And the reason why the third proof is so much longer than the first two, I would attribute to the following phenomenon, that for the first two cases, there is essentially only example which achieves the minimum growth. It's arithmetic progression. For the second case, it's no longer the case. There are two essentially different sets which grow four times under this operation. It's arithmetic progression, still, and there is also the following construction. Take any two residue classes in Mod 3, any two you like. And now take any interval of integers, and now look at the integers in this interval, which are in these residue classes, two residue classes you picked. This is a set. It's different from arithmetic progression, and yet it also grows the same way. It grows four times under A plus 3A. And why this is why this should convince you that the proof of thirds should be longer. I didn't say harder, longer. The reason for is the following, that it's a general principle, I believe, in mathematics, that the more, if you solve an extremal problem, then the solution to extremal problem should be longer if there are more extremal configurations. Because whatever your solution is, it has to somehow to account for all these different extremal configurations that could possibly arise. And the more there are them there are, the more complicated a solution generally should to be. Yet this is a general principle, it's not a theorem or anything. Now, what if you look at A plus lambda, things will get even worse for a general lambda. Because we can carry out the same construction. Namely, we can take any subset of residue classes mod lambda, take those integers in any given interval which lie in these residue classes, and this will grow lambda plus one times. And same way F-many progression does. And so there are quite a lot of subsets of residue classes, approximately 2 to the power lambda of them. And so there should be, we expect, again, we don't have a proof of that, but we expect there will be many different and differently looking minimizers. And because of this, the case checking argument should get nastier, nastier, and nastier until our patient runs out. So it looks grim. The good news is that one can actually prove a lower bound which is of right order of magnitude. So this is the theorem, one of the things I want to talk about today. So what it says, the statement is here written, but what it says intuitively is the following. That if you take any set of integers, then it grows at least as much as the as many progression of the same size would grow. So there is one caveat, of course. Since this is not that good of a theorem, or actually I should say proof of this theorem is not that good. I'll talk about it later. But so the caveat is that there is an error term to be which is little of size of the set. So the truth should be, of course, that it should grow this many times minus some constant, which will depend on lambdas in appropriate ways. But the way I can prove it introduces an error term, which is grows slightly smaller than size of the set, but not actually much smaller than size of the set. It's just like double log smaller, very slowly smaller. But at least the leading term is what you think it is. And so the statement is the following. Now let's actually read what it actually says formally. That the size of the sum set lambda 1a plus lambda 2a and some blah, 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 up to lambda ka is the sum of lambdas times size of a minus error term. And if your lambdas aren't positive, which they well might be, I never said it multiplied by positive integers, then you just take absolute values. And there is, of course, one condition to reckon with, is that lambdas need to be coprime. Because if they aren't coprime, there is a common factor. You just divide this common factor out, and this doesn't change the size of the sum set at all, because it just scales everything. So you need the numbers to be coprime. However, they don't need to be pairwise coprime. They can as well be two of them can have a common factor. Just they have to be coprime altogether. There is no single number divides them all. Okay, so this is the result. Any questions so far before I switch the topic a little? No. Okay. The next thing that I'm going to talk about. Oh, there's a question.
So the little wave term, is that independent of the constant wave, independent of lambda?
Yeah, good question. It is dependent of lambdas. It's for figure fixed lambda, this term is independent. But it depends on lambda, and it depends very nastily on lambda. Because. Well, the way from the proof, it depends really nastily. It depends on lambdas very much. And it actually has to depend on lambdas. But not as nastily as proof gives. Okay. Any more questions? Listen? No. Okay, so next topic one we should consider, once we have some semblance of right or lower bounds, is the upper bounds. And the upper bounds, if you ask just obvious question, like how large it can be, actually turns out rather trivial. You know, just take a set which is completely dissociated, there are no relations between elements. It's going to give you the maximizer. The more interesting is the Plunicke-type upper bounds. So let me explain by what I mean by Plunicke-type upper bounds. There is this theorem of Plunicke, which asserts that if a set doesn't grow by much when you add it to itself, then if every subset which you form using this set will also not grow much at all. So precisely with what it says, that if A plus A is at most some constant times A, then if you add it to itself some number of times, say T times, then the size of this grows at most, it's at most k times the power t times more than the size of A. So you can control the growth of all any kind of subset, including only k, by the growth of only one of them, A plus A. There are more general results than this, but this is just for illustration. Now, how does it relate to the sums of dilates? There is an obvious, simple relation. You can, if you know that A plus A goes most k times, you can also bound the growth of the dilates, trivially. Namely, you just observe that lambda times A is contained in A plus A plus A plus A lambda times. And therefore, you obtain what I would call a trivial bound by a simple containment relation. One, of course, naturally can wonder, well, how sharp this bound is. And it turns out, unsurprisingly, I would say, that this bound is nowhere near to be sharp. There is a result one can prove, which replaces the additive dependence of lambda. So instead of getting sums of lambdas in the exponent, you get essentially the sums of logarithms of lambdas in the exponent. There are, of course, again, some things to be told. Of course, there are some constants appearing, like 20, but the idea is that dependence is logarithmic. And the logarithmic dependence is actually the right dependence, so you can actually improve it to any slower Galerolle function in the logarithm. Question there? No? Okay. You cannot improve it to anything better. So 20, of course, is artifact of the proof. It's not the right number. So this result might seem to you, why bother? And to convince you at least a little bit why would you bother about it, let me give an application of it. Here's an application. Sure. Which one? No, it's just a parenthesis. Just like way the round parentheses are, this is a square parenthesis. No, this is not an integer part. It would be way too good to be true had it been an integer part. Capital K, it's a doubling of say A plus A, so let me write it down here. So this is the standing assumption that we have. So A plus A is at most k times size of A. It's a doubling constant of A. Okay? Okay. Anything unclear else? Okay, so then let's move on to corollary. Corollary is the following application to extremal problem for linear equations. So in other words, it's a standard theme in additive combinatorics. Given a linear equation, like x plus y equals z plus w, like a Sidon equation, or x plus y equals 2z, three-term arithmetic progression equation, how large a set can be without containing this solutions to this equation? Of course, one needs to say what it means containing a solution, because there are always trivial solutions. One way to say it is there are no distinct, so all the elements of the solution are distinct integers. That's one way to say it. Not bad. So for equations of which are symmetric, in a sense that the left side is same as the right side, same coefficients. Example would be Sidon equation, but this is more general. One can actually throw an upper bound on the size of any such set, which cannot even contain solution to this equation, indistinct integers. And the bound is square root of n, pretty much, minus a small shaving of in an exponent. So it's n to the power 1/2 minus something which is which is positive. And this something, and this shaving in exponent is proportional to 1 over log the norm of the coefficients. I'm sorry, I don't hear you. Yes. So, okay, so the pigeon, because remember, I'm asking about distinct solutions. You cannot ensure this pigeonhole principle that this in the solution they obtain, all the entries are going to be distinct. And actually, the trivial bound is square root. And there are examples that show you can get square root minus any epsilon, and this epsilon will depend on the coefficients. So this is actually strictly necessary. You cannot improve it to 1/2 minus anything constant. Whatever you improve it by has to depend on lambda. That answers the question? Okay. And actually, not that I know of. That's the only thing I can say. Okay. All right. This upper bound that I just wrote, with saving being proportional to 1 over log the norm of the lambdas, it actually turns out to be tight. I will not show you an example which demonstrates this is tight, but the logarithmic dependence here is again tight. Which so it's actually a rare instance when we have any semblance of a tight result for the size of the set which avoids solutions to a given linear equation. So that's an application. And in remaining time, I want to sketch an idea, actually two ideas, if time permits, which go into the proof of the lower bound, because upper bound is actually the Sponecker-type bound is actually just a trick. The lower bound proof, I believe, is more useful, so I want to present a piece of it. Okay, so let me go to the idea number one. The idea number one is the following. First of all, in order to prove, I will illustrate it for the case A plus lambda A. This is the simplest case. It has pretty much almost all the essential ingredients for the general case, and it will be much easier to explain. So in order to prove that A plus lambda A is at least lambda plus one times size of A, it means, if you unfold the little law of definition, is that you actually need to prove that A plus lambda is at least lambda plus one minus some constant given to you in advance by adversary, say, for all sufficiently large A. So we need to prove this statement, which you see above. And what's the strategy? Strategy is the following. We are going to partition our set A into pieces. And we are going to prove this statement for each of the pieces, and we'll use it, and then we combine these estimates together. Okay, so how do we partition our set? The way we partition our set, we look to our set modulo lambda. So we define A of I to be basically those elements of A which are congruent to I mod lambda. And what's the crucial observation? The crucial observation is that we have this inequality, that A plus lambda A is at least the size of A plus 1 plus lambda A, and so on and so forth. The reason is rather simple, namely that these sets are actually disjoint, because all the elements here, and A1 plus lambda A1, are congruent to 1 all the sets in the second set, some set belong to, can go to 2, and so on. So we have this inequality, and if you can prove this for this theorem for each of the AIs, we sum the estimates, we get a theorem for A itself. So it suffices to establish a theorem only for AIs. Now, this is idea number one. It's not yet enough to show the whole theorem. The second is the idea is the following lemma. Again, our AIs are just those integers in A which can go into I, mod lambda. And it's the following lemma, which is to say that if all of these AIs are non-empty sets, then we are actually done. And the reason for this is rather simple. I already outlined it in the previous slide, essentially, that if you look at A1 plus lambda A, these numbers are congruent to 1, A2 plus lambda A congruent to 2 mod lambda, and so on. They're all disjoint, and therefore, if you sum their sizes up and use the fact that the size some set of the two sets has size at least the sum of the sizes of our original set minus 1, what we will obtain is that we are summing something which includes A lambda times, and then includes each of the I's. But AIs form partition of A. So we get another copy of A. So we get lambda plus 1 times the size of A minus some constant. But we don't care about constants at this point. So this is the idea number 2. So we are very close to being done, actually. And so the final step is the following, essentially, algorithm. So if you're handed a set A, which is subset of some interval of density alpha, and you want to show that it grows lambda plus 1 times when you look at A plus lambda A, then we do the following algorithm. We look at our set A, and now we make the set A1 to true alpha A lambda. If they're all unempty, we are done. If they are not non-empty, if there is at least one empty set, we use the first idea, and we say it's sufficient to prove it for only for AIs. So we forget about, we recurse, and what's the advantage of recursion is that the density increases because there is an empty piece we left out. So average density of this AIs is larger than that of the set A. We repeat, repeat, and repeat. Each time the average density increases, but it cannot increase indefinitely, of course. We have to stop sometime. And if we stop, it means that all these parts that we have are actually taken care of. So that's an outline. And I'm out of time, so I will stop here. Thank you for the attention.